It is now.
Three, two, one. Welcome to the show. I'm Chuck Anderson. I have an exciting show. It's a part two, and we seldom have that opportunity to have a two-part program. Part one, last week, as you recall, we had Roy and Lucille Fitz, and they live on a farm just northwest of DeSmet, South Dakota. We had a chance to mention that, man, he knew Harvey Dunn, Carolyn Ingalls, the mother of Mary Ingalls. We went through the various moments of the early teens, and now I asked them if we could talk about the Depression. And of course, Roy said that there's two aspects to that, and I want to start right off by thanking my wonderful host, Lucille Fitz, for a wonderful lunch. I forgot what you guys eat like on the farm, and that was only a 10 o'clock lunch. What all did we have?
Well, we didn't have much. I usually cook a big meal.
I mean, for coffee, like, that's all I have is coffee.
Like pork chops, potatoes, and gravy, and apple pie.
Oh, man. There's nothing like being on the farm, and I had an opportunity before the show started to just take a walk, go around the farm. And as I said, it's since I've been a kid that I've really been out on a farm, and I recognized Roy, the chicken coop, because that's the one that faces south and has the windows. Was I right?
Right.
Hey, I recognized a hog house out there.
Right.
Okay, so that's kind of the farm kid in me. Roy, thank you so much for coming back on part two.
It's my pleasure.
And Lucille, besides, thank you for being a wonderful guest. And some of the best coffee I have had, maybe since I was in the Marine Corps and the Navy, guys made that good coffee. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, we have to attribute that to that good water that we have, rural water now, so we can make good coffee.
And that water probably has something to do with the Big Slough and Silver Lake going all the way back to Little House on the Prairie.
It probably could, but we hauled our own water for 50 years, and it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me when we got this rural water. I'm so thankful.
Now, is this the water that comes all the way from the Missouri River?
No,
it comes from north of DeSmet there. There's two or three wells there, and it's stored in that giant place north of DeSmet.
I knew I was going to be wrong on that. There's about 40 people sitting around the table, and they all looked at me shocked, and they all shook their heads. Absolutely not. It's not Missouri River water, but comes from
north of DeSmet, and that's just the best water in the country.
Roy, I want to know... get into really some tough times of the United States. We're going to get into the 30s. We have the stock market crash. We have the horrible Dust Bowl years. And I was born in 1936, so I'm going to have some identity with some of those stories. I remember in our pre-program interview, you mentioned 1936 as being a hot year. So when we get to that, I'm going to ask, how did they cool these little babies off? There was no air conditioning, no electricity. Roy, I know that you have mentioned that that horrible era was really broken into two segments. And I'm just going to let you start where you think it's appropriate.
Well, the first segment, I would say, was a financial collapse of the border trade and the New York Stock Exchange. That happened in September 29 of 1929. And I'm not sure what day it fell on. We were just talking a while ago. I was thinking it was a Thursday, which they called a Black Thursday, but I was kind of corrected on that. It could have been a Friday, which they dubbed it the Black Friday. Anyway,
whatever day it was, it was really black.
It was a disaster of the financial situation of the whole United States. There was a lot of grown men come out of that stock exchange crying because they'd lost everything they had. Some of them went off and committed suicide because the stock market crashed, completely wiped them out. Well, anyway, from there on, we finally felt the pinch of it in the early 30s. Our prices went down to nothing. 1932.
Out here, you mean
in
the Dakotas?
In this area of the Dakotas. We didn't feel it too much in 1929, but by 1932, we were feeling the effects of the stock market crash on Wall Street in that year of 29, because our prices went down to nothing. Now, the drought had already started to settle in about 1929. It wasn't a big crop, but there was some grain raised, and especially in the lower ground where there was some moisture, there was a fair crop. Well, in 1930, it was less and got hotter, because I remember that was the year I graduated out of high school, in the spring of 1930. My dad let me put in about 20 acres of flax out back here, and I had to go to Arlington and buy the seed. It cost me $7.50 a bushel for the seed. Well, a bushel would plant 2 acres in those days. We didn't plant it very thick. Well, anyway, that flax got up about 18 inches tall. It looked pretty good. It started to go into bloom. And about that time, we got 6 weeks of steady, hot wind right while that flax was in bloom. Well, that cooked the flax, the pollination. And, of course, any plant, if it doesn't pollinate successfully, there goes your crop or yield, whatever you want to call it. I could bust probably four bowls open of this flax and then get one little flat seed. So it never even pulled the binder out on that flax that year. The hot winds had just destroyed the pollen. Well, that 30 was really getting real dry. 31 was much worse. The dust storms started to come, and the tumbleweeds, we called them, which were Russian thistles, yeah, that was the real term of them. They're kind of a kosher weed is what they are, but another name for them is Russian thistle. And we eventually nicknamed them the tumbleweeds. Well, 32, 3, and I don't know about 4, because I was in the CC camp then, but that was a bad, bad year too. Each year successfully got worse and more dust blowing. The 11th of November in 1933, I was in DeSmet, and it was one of those black days. Armistice Day, November 11th.
Let me say right now to the listeners, he's looking over at Lucille, and now and then, although Roy's mind is, well, sure better than mine. I can't even remember my daughter's birthday, so you got all these dates back there. But now and then, you'll hear Lucille coming in, and vice versa. When I'm visiting with Lucille, you'll hear Roy coming in.
Well, anyway, I was in DeSmet. I think I was signing up for the CC camp, which is the Civilian Conservation Corps. Is instigated by Franklin Roosevelt to take the young guys. There were a lot of, you know, high school graduates and young fellows, and that no jobs available. The economy of the land was down to zero. So Franklin Roosevelt instigated this Civilian Conservation Corps, and they had CC camps all over the country. So, I was sent to Hill City, 4 miles northwest of Hill City, and out there we were building roads and thinning jack pine and making the Black Hills a scenic area, which it is now. All those little artificial lakes were built by the CC boys. Even Sylvan Lake had been originally built by the Bureau of Reclamation. But the CC camp was established near Sylvan Lake, and they raised the level of the dam, and of course that raised the level of the lake and improved the scenery around the lake. They cleaned it up, and the CCs did a lot of wonderful good for the future or follow-up tourist business that flocks to the Black Hills this day and age.
What was the difference between that? My dad worked with WPA, the
Works
Public.
It was Works Progress Administration, uh-huh. was what that was called. Mm-hmm. And young guys nicknamed that We Putter Around, which was, was more or less a mistake. But that was for the older married men that couldn't leave their families in this area, and they built these county roads.
Okay.
And they built these artificial dams like Lake Iroquois, Lake Osceola, and probably that lake south of Miller. I'm not sure about that, but my dad helped build Lake Iroquois, and with four horses. And he had to farm them out to a neighbor over there at night, you know. They'd put them in his barn. But I think he got $40 a month and furnished four horses and the feed for them. Out in CC camp, we were to get $30 a month, but 25 of it was sent home, and they retained $5 in camp for us CC boys. And out of that $5, they took 25 cents for laundry. So we had the whole sum of $4.75 to blow in 30 days.
Of course, you could get some awfully great big ice cream cones for a nickel.
Well,
Coke was a nickel, and things were a lot cheaper, so that went.
Right.
Before we leave this segment, to just let the people know that the crash, just the economic crash, didn't necessarily mean the demise of South Dakota. It was started a long time before that. And just briefly, we'll go through what happened.
And the drought added to the financial crisis.
That's
so
right.
The two together made a disastrous situation for most all of east of South Dakota, from this area on west.
Give an example of what that acre. Well, I'm going to look right out your farm window. Right now, we're going to look south. What would that acre have been worth, let's say, turn of the century, 1910, 1911?
Well, I suppose around $35 or $40 an acre. Then by 1915, the land agents got a hold of the people in the east, and by that time, the inflation had brought it up to $45 and $50.
And then by 1932, what are we looking at?
Probably $5 an acre.
Oh, wow. Roy and Lucille Fitz. We're going to be back, ladies and gentlemen, with a lovely couple from a farm just northwest of DeSmet, South Dakota. This is Chuck Anderson. Be back in 60 seconds.
Hey, that's polishing the apple, isn't it?
Yeah.
$45. It's probably only been 35 years before.
That's okay. Everybody's just visiting. We're sitting at the dining table of Roy and Lucille Fitz, and that's okay. I started to talk, and everybody quieted down. That's okay. You guys, if you want to visit, that's okay. And in fact, I should mention that occasionally there has been a good academic question brought up by other people here, and if you want to throw that question out, if I've missed something, do please feel free to come out with it. Lucille, thank you very much for the coffee, cookies. What'd you call that stuff? It was kind of a coleslaw. It wasn't coleslaw. What was it I was eating?
Oh, well, that was a macaroni salad with Dream Whip in it and fruit. And
you were throwing some sort of names out of a foreign language I didn't even understand. Was that Finnish?
No.
What was it?
I'm Danish.
Danish, okay.
I'm not mixed up at all. I'm a pure Dane.
So occasionally is you guys go into this foreign language, and I didn't even know what you were talking about. But it was very good, whatever it was. Yeah. Lucille, thanks for being back with us.
It's fruit soup.
And now and then, it's okay, Lucille, because you may want to dicker on the date of something when Roy is talking, and you say, no, that was 1910, my darling, and that's okay. Roy, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
The economy now, Roy, let's get to what happened to this part of the country. 1929... People have actually, they've lost their fortunes on the stock market crash, and it didn't exactly start to seep out here, you say, for really a year or two until you really began to feel it. Now, Let's talk about what happened when you did begin to feel it. What happened to the merchants? What happened to the farmers? What happened to the prices?
Well, that's what took place. The prices started to fall on all commodities, land and everything. Anything you had, livestock or anything, just went down to practically nothing. In fact, the government paid $20 for the best cow you had, and they slaughtered a lot of that livestock because the feed was not available in this country, and then as a humane effort, I guess that was their main principle, to thin out the livestock because the feed wasn't available.
Because of the drought.
Because of that severe drought. And it got to the point in 1933, our county treasury was not getting in any money because people was losing their land. They'd borrowed on it. And the insurance companies had loaned money, several insurance companies loaned money on land, and then they started to foreclose when the owner could not keep up the payments. The state of South Dakota had what they called a loan program. They called it rural credits. A lot of the farmers lost their land to the state rural credits. You don't ever hear of that now. It's ancient history. But that was another place that they were foreclosing on these farmers. And I think I've read where the statistics was only 39% of the farmers were losing their land, but in this area that was absolutely wrong. I would say it was 89%. My dad nearly lost his land. He accumulated a debt of between $800 and $900, no way to pay it off. Hogs was only 2 cents a pound if you could find a buyer to pay that price. Oats got down to 5 cents a bushel for number two. Barley got to 6 cents. Corn got to 10 cents. And wheat was down as low as 18 cents a bushel.
18 cents a
bushel. Well, there's no way, even if you had the wheat, that you could pay a debt of any size off. But by 1932 and 3, we had a drought here in this area in 1932 that didn't raise a bit of grain. From Woolsey West, they had a fair crop. There was an area clear out to Gettysburg that had a little rain, and they raised pretty good crop of wheat. But for 18 cents a bushel, they were really actually losing money harvesting the crop of wheat,
hauling it to market, etc.
And I have the exact story on that from Art Lake. He run the East Elevator in Gettysburg, and he and I got to be pretty good friends. I would deal with him when I was trucking, and he told me in 1932 they had this 18 cent wheat, and he didn't have the heart to pay 18 cents, so he did pay 25 cents a bushel. He set up two big steel bins on the west side of his elevator, filled them with 25 cent wheat in 32. Well, he set on that wheat because in 1933 then they didn't have a crop. And in the spring of 34, he told me out of his own mouth, he sold that wheat in Minneapolis and got $1.25 a bushel.
Okay.
So even in the 30s,
were people making some money.
There was people very few people, but there was some that was making money. And then 35 in this area, we had a little bit of moisture come in the winter of 34 and 5. And those that had the courage and the credit and the machinery, a lot of farmers had lost their land, their machinery, but they were still allowed to live on the land. But if they didn't have the machinery, then how was they going to farm the land? But in 1935, if you had the courage and credit, there was a little bit of a crop raised. But then in 1936 was the extreme drought again and hot summer.
That's the year I was born, 1936.
It got to 120 degrees in Pierre and Philip. Huron got a high temperature recorded. I'm pretty sure if you look back, you'll find 118 recorded at Huron. Hmm. DeSmet got to be 115, their high recording. So there was absolutely no crop raised around this area in 1936. Well, then the winter of 36.
Let me stop on the summer here, Art. Here's an infant, just born, little Charles. They didn't have air conditioning. We didn't even have electricity where we were at. How in the world did they keep these little babies cool?
Well, the ladies would wet towels, and they, through the process of heat and evaporation, you know, it sets up a cooling action. Uh-huh. That's where your jugs wrapped with burlap, uh-huh, soaked with water, it would keep that water partially cool inside. And that's the way they kept those. And then they'd put curtains over the windows because we was having dirt storms. Well, keep the hot sun out.
My mother said that a lot of times she would just get the old pan out with a little water in it and just lay me in that pan of water. It just, I can't imagine that kind of heat. And then, of course, all of the other crises that are going on.
Well, this heat period, the humidity was way down to nothing, see. When you have heat and humidity, you have suffering. But when you have just plain heat and no humidity, I suppose it got down to 2% humidity in this country about that time when the heat really led. Well, you didn't feel the heat as bad with the low humidity. And that's why people in New Mexico love their climate. They get hot out there, but their humidity is way low. So you don't suffer with the heat in a hot climate if the humidity is low.
How could you keep, now maybe this is something for Lucille, how in the world did the women keep the dust out?
Well,
Or maybe you didn't.
After every dirt storm, then you had to get busy and just take down all the curtains. Everything was covered with dust. Just everything.
And, wow.
And
A film or pretty thick?
Just thick dust on the floor everywhere. On your bed covers, everything was covered with dust.
On the bed?
Yes. The quilts were covered with dust, and you couldn't hardly breathe. And then we'd take wet towels and pack them in the windowsills, you know, in places like that to try and keep the dirt out. And that's, well, all you could do is just clean after every storm, and that was quite often.
Well, like I told you, 11th of November 1933, I was in DeSmet. I think I was signing up for the CC camp out in the Black Hills. And it was one of those blackout days. The dirt storm was so severe you couldn't see a man 20 feet ahead of you. And I happened to walk by they had the street lights on in DeSmet, and of course the lights would not penetrate, blow dirt. And there was two men standing under that street light talking, and as I walked by I heard one man say to the other, "Do you think the world's coming to an end?" And he meant it, because it was very, very eerie, right in the very middle of the day, and you couldn't even see the sun. You couldn't see 30 feet ahead of you. In fact, our neighbors had a fairly new car that was coming down the highway, and they run right into the back of a maintainer right in the middle of the day in one of them terrible dust storms. Printer killed themselves
because
they couldn't even see the maintainer with his lights. Till he was right there and hit it.
Was this the time now also where you had those clouds, those big black clouds
and
grasshoppers?
Black clouds and grasshoppers moved in from the west. After they'd eaten up all the crop in the west.
How far west?
Well, clear.
Western South Dakota?
All western South Dakota. Of course, up in the grassland, up in Perkins and Harding County, there wasn't any crops to speak of up there. It was prairie grassland.
So they would just like lift up in one huge giant cloud?
When the wind would come tearing out of the northwest, we'd see them big black clouds coming. Well, we wonder if we're going to get rain. All we was getting then when it did hit here was dirt and grasshoppers. Come in by the millions. The grasshoppers ate everything that was green in this country.
Hmm.
In 32, 3, and 4, and up to, and even in 36.
Wow. Now, I hate to stop right here because, again, I enjoy the history of this nation and the hardships that you people went through. Now, that would have been my parents. Like I said, I was born in 36, and I'm appreciating it so much that you're sharing this with us. We're with Roy and Lucille Fitz, farmers just northwest of DeSmet, South Dakota, and just had a nice, lovely breakfast here, or lunch, whatever they call it. We're going to be back in 60 seconds. Don't go away. Now leave the radio right there. We will be back. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson.
Picking up on what, a radio?
Three, two, one. Welcome back. This is Chuck Anderson. My guest today are Roy and Lucille Fitz from DeSmet, South Dakota, farmers about northwest, kind of like about 4 miles. And you guys don't now get particular and say it's 4.3 or 4.5. These people have such wonderful memories that I have to be very careful what I say, or I'm very quickly told, no, that's not exactly right, Chuck. It's at this point that I want to thank all of the listeners out there, wherever you're at, out in the garage, working on the car, out boating, fishing, hunting, just in general, driving down the road. And if you are, just sit back and relax, because for the rest of the half hour, I want to entertain you with some fabulous stories that will be coming out of the 30s. And these are locked into the minds of Roy and Lucille Fitz, and we've asked them to share them with our listeners in the four states. So I'm suspecting, Roy and Lucille, that there's a lot of people that are going to be able to identify with the stories that you've been telling. Hey, Roy, you just talked about a bank holiday.
Well, when Franklin Roosevelt run for office, of course, people wanted a change. They'd gone through the Hoover administration, and they blamed Hoover for the financial disaster of the country, and I don't know if you can blame him entirely. It was one of the situations that develop about every decade or so. But anyway, Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, and he took office in February of 33. Well, about a month or 6 weeks later, he declared what they called a bank holiday, because he had run on the campaign of a New Deal. Well, the conditions of the financial situation in the whole United States at that time was pretty near on rock bottom. The prices had devaluated way down to nothing. And there was no way, the factories were closing, people were out of work, they were on bread lines in the industrial east, soup lines and everything else. So he declared a bank holiday. We were on what they called the blanket money. It was about a third bigger than what we're carrying now in size, and it was backed by gold that was stored in caves at Fort Knox, Kentucky. Of course, these caves were fortified and guarded, and they had this gold bullion in these caves. And the money that we were on prior to the bank holiday was payable upon demand in gold. Well, they called in all those certificates of gold certificates, called in all the gold coins. My uncle in Dixon, Illinois, my dad's oldest brother, he had a bunch of those $50 gold pieces. If, as I remember, they were just a little smaller than our silver dollars. I just got, of course, to look at them one quick glance, because they were valuable even in 33, you know. But the government called all that gold in. Well, then they come out with the size certificates that we're carrying now, only they were backed by silver. Okay, there's the two changes that I remember seeing in my lifetime, but I got another one coming up for you. Those silver certificates disappeared in 1964. That was the last of them. You look at your bills now. All they are is a promissory note backed by nothing but the government, but it's legal tender for all bills. I think it says on them. There is a three monetary changes I have seen in my lifetime, and I hope I don't live to see the fourth one.
You were mentioning a great story during the break on the car licenses, but we're going to come back to that, Roy, because right now, I think for the women, it would be very interesting to know. And I asked Lucille to just pick the year 1936, because that's when I was born, May 21st, actually, Lucille, to get very, very personal there, May of 36. A typical day. Now, you're married. You and Roy are married, right?
Well, we were living with his folks because, well, we didn't have any money to start with, and this farm had a big debt on it. So we were all kind of living over there together, and Roy was trucking, and his sister was teaching, and his brother-in-law was trucking, and I was there helping Roy's mother with the work at home, and also...
What kind of work?
Well, just washing and ironing and just housework.
What? How'd you wash? You didn't have these new electric washing machines and dryers?
We had a handy Maytag washing machine that with a gas motor on it, and that was pretty nice because
it actually rotated back and forth.
It was just a real good machine, and I used to wash for eight people, and there was eight of us here, and there was a lot of washing done, especially in the wintertime. You'd hang some of that on the line, you'd try to get it off, and it was froze.
It had those ringers on it where it would wring the water out, and then had that solar energy dryer out there on the clothesline?
Yes, that natural dryer out there on the clothesline. And then, when Roy's dad needed help, I was the one that had to do the helping. I helped him.
The man's help?
Mm-hmm. I helped him cut grain. I ran the tractor for him while he cut his grain. I ran the tractor for him while he cultivated the new shelter belt. And I was jack of all trades.
Plus, you had to feed the guys because they got hungry. They're out working really, really hard.
Roy's mother was the chief cook, but we always helped, helped her out, and there was a lot of canning to do. We done lots of canning. I think one year when the two Roys brought in some peaches from southern Illinois, I think we canned something like 80 or 90 quarts of peaches. But there was a lot of us over there to eat, so we needed a lot of, we'd done a lot of canning. And
did you have one of those storm cellars, and then in summer it kind of worked as one of those places, they call it it was cool. You could put stuff down there and kind of keep it cool.
Yes. His dad and the two boys made one over there, and they kept the potatoes down in that storm cellar. And that was a pretty good place, but we didn't keep any food down there. We had the cistern that we used to have a pail that we'd put the butter and the milk in that and then drop that down in the cistern, and once in a while that rope would break.
Oh, my. Then what'd you do?
I had to fish all that out and pump the water out and get some clean water in there from the well.
Because that was your drinking water.
That was our
area. Now, a lot of people's wells out towards Redfield, west of Huron, they dried up. They had no water at all.
Oh, this is an artesian well. But in what year did we put in the new well, Dad?
In about 52, I believe it was.
So it lasted that long?
We had to put in a new well. I remember the people that came here from Huron. What was their name? The well driller from Huron.
Yeah.
And anyway, they drilled day and night till they got water. They never stopped. So they had to have lunch at midnight and everything, and that was kind of... And then when they hit water, there's 1,300 feet deep, our well. 1190 feet deep.
Mm-hmm. What was a typical afternoon like for you? Now, you've fed the men, you and your mother-in-law, you've fed the men. What'd you do now? Is it like time? Can you take a break? Can you take a nap? What are you doing?
No. We never bothered to take a nap because there was always something to be doing. I had a baby to take care of and a lot of work to be done.
Now, how did you keep your baby cool, 1936?
Well, I don't know. It seemed like the upstairs was terribly hot over there, but I remember taking a quilt and bringing it down, laying in front of the door, and the baby and I would lay there where it was cooler at night. That's all I remember.
What would happen, like, if the baby ever got sick? Did you have a doctor close by?
Yep, Dr. Cheddar. Dr. Paul Cheddar was in DeSmet at that time, and he was our doctor.
Is that right?
And then later he moved to Huron. He was our doctor till he retired.
I knew Libby Cheddar very well, Dick Cheddar's mother. Yep. Did you know Libby before they were married?
Sure.
Did you?
Yeah.
What was Libby like?
Well, she was a pretty girl.
She was from DeSmet.
Yeah. Boy, of course, I didn't know the difference between girls and boys much in those days. I wasn't interested in girls, but I don't know. She was just
a swell lady.
A nice lady, yeah. She was a pretty girl.
Huh. Yeah. So, let's say you don't have much money. How did you pay the bills?
Well, there really wasn't too much. We used to give Roy's mother so much a week to buy groceries and we all just chipped in on that, and then I don't know.
Is Roy out trucking at this time?
Yes.
So that helped bring in some outside money.
That had to bring in the money, and then the two boys trucked, and Bernice taught school, and they gathered up enough money, and Roy's dad went in and paid off the bill.
When it was this dusty, when you're talking about those black dust clouds coming in from the northwest, and it's so thick inside the house that it layered itself even on the bed. Well, how did you keep the baby from breathing that?
Well, it wasn't so bad then, not at that time. It was back in when I was at home with my folks that it was the worst. The year that I graduated from high school, I couldn't even put my good dress on till I got into town into the school, because the dust was so bad and so thick that you couldn't dress up. You just get dirty, that's all.
Huh. How about supper time now? Is it the same sort of routine as it was for lunch, that it's your mother-in-law and you that are preparing the meal for the men?
I guess so. That's the way it was.
Now, did you have a refrigerator in those days?
Oh, no, not. Years later, Roy brought home a used refrigerator from Wisconsin. It was a kerosene refrigerator, and we thought we really had it made.
Oh, you did, yeah. So you could you make ice cubes?
Yes, and we had ice cubes, and the neighbor kids would stop and they'd come from school, and they'd say, oh, ice. You've got ice in the lemonade or Kool-Aid or whatever I had. They thought that was great.
What'd you do for entertainment, Lucille, in the evening time? It's past supper, and we've got the dishes all done. What'd the men do at that time?
I don't know. Roy wasn't around much. He was gone most of the time.
Out trucking, trying to make money to support his habit of being a farmer.
He had to make a living. Yeah.
What'd the women do?
Well, I don't know.
Quilting?
Yeah, I'd done quite a lot of sewing when I was younger.
And there wasn't television. My gosh, what in the world did you do for entertainment without television?
Why, I don't think I
was. Were you able to live without television?
I don't believe I would have missed it at all.
Well, you didn't even know that you were missing it.
No, I wasn't any hand to even turn on the radio. I don't know if we even had one, come to think about it. Oh, Roy brought home a battery radio from Montgomery Ward store in Minneapolis. That I do remember, and that was our first radio.
We'll be back with Mr. and Mrs. Roy Fitz. Just an incredible hour. I cannot believe my production director is pointing. It says we're at the end of the third segment, and we will have about 12 minutes left when we're back. Meanwhile, we will be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. 3, 2, 1. This is Chuck Anderson. Thanks ever so much for staying with us. We're back, and we also appreciate you letting us be part of your morning's entertainment. I want to thank our volunteer people who has helped us on the production end. Kept me right smack on. I want to thank Roy and Lucille Fitz from Northwest of DeSmet for sharing with us the times, the stories of those horrible periods of late 1929 through the 30s. And even though we ran this show in two parts, we had them on last week, and I want to thank them so much for that. It's incredible, their memories. Roy is 82 years old, and Lucille is, well, let's see, she was born September 29th, 1915, so that makes her a little bit younger. Their memories are great. And in February, they've been married 60 years. The car license, Roy.
Well, in 1932 and 3, there was everybody had lost their land, and most of them had lost machinery too. They had mortgaged it, and to get money to live on, and there was no income. And in the treasurer's office in Kingsbury County, it got so tough. In about 1933, I had an aunt and an uncle that lived in DeSmet. He had lost his land, run for registered deeds, and he got the job. Well, I suppose this was 1932, the election, but in 33, it got to where there wasn't any money coming into the treasury in the county, or very little. And the county commissioners decreed if you didn't have your license, your taxes paid, you couldn't buy your car license. Wow. Well, that backfired right in their face, because they couldn't pay their taxes, so they legally couldn't buy their car license. So they would load up what little cream and butter they might have and go into town in the late evening, about dark, park in the alley, go in the back door of the produce house and sell their what cream and eggs they had, get the check, go out the front door, go in the front door of the grocery store down the street, buy what groceries that check would buy, come out the back door and get in their car and drive home. Well, the sheriff knew it, but there was no money in the treasurer. He just looked the other way. Long as you parked in the alley, he just looked the other way and let you do it, because there was no money to feed him. If he put you in the jail, they couldn't feed you. They didn't have the money. So that's how tough it got in 1933 financially. And that ruling held for 2 or 3 months, and they see it wasn't working at all. They rescinded that mandate that you had to have your car license or your taxes paid before you could buy your car license. And at that time, a car license was $6.25. In 1934, I started trucking, and my truck license was $16.25. But it was just awfully hard to raise that $6.25 for just even a car license. Gasoline, you could get 7 gallons for a dollar. There was a Webb station right back of Ward's store in DeSmet. The Washburns run it, and my cousin, Clyde Boyer, run it for a while. And I think the gas price was $15.03 a gallon, but rather than fool with change, they'd pump in 7 gallons if you had a dollar bill. And that's how gasoline got to be cheap in DeSmet. And then when I was on the road trucking, I was going into Nebraska and Kansas, and the cheapest I could find in the various states I was going into was at Sioux Center, Iowa. The two elevator boys had opened up the North Elevator in Sioux Center on Highway 75. They were selling gasoline at 12.5 cents a gallon. There was 4 cents Iowa state tax on it at that time. So that left 8.5 cents for the refinery at McPherson, Kansas, the shippers, the railroad, to bring it up to Sioux Center, and the elevator boys had to get a few pennies out of a gallon. But can anybody believe that I was buying gas cheaper in Iowa than I could in Kansas, right across from an oil well pumping over there by Wichita?
And you at least were bringing in an outside income, and the teacher, man, that's helping to have that teacher income. hey, there had to have been neighbors. Like you say, there were no factories out here. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why your family went back there in, what, 1915 or so?
Yeah.
So there must have been some awful misery by maybe just close by neighbors. What'd they do, Lucille? Well, how'd they eat?
Well, I often wonder how we at times we didn't have very much to eat. That's for sure. But we were just thankful.
Did you ever go to bed hungry?
No, not really, but we surely could have had more, but my mother, somehow or other, they managed to get some flour and a little sugar and some coffee and just the very, very slim essence of life, you know, just to get by. But my folks were very, very poor. Dad worked, too, for the WPA, but he only got $3.50 a week.
Well, the government see that the people were starving out here, some of them, you know, and they shipped in commodities from Missouri and Arkansas, and they would distribute it to the real destitute people. So that helped keep some of the real destitute alive. Now, we always, in our area here, we had a lot of pheasants in the 30s. They were living on the wild sunflowers that grew in out of the ditches, and they just seemed to thrive on that dry weather.
Well, isn't that something?
You'd wonder how they got moisture enough, but they seemed like the pheasants just kept getting thicker and thicker. And by the early 40s, when war broke out, man, they got so thick in this country, you could legally shoot 12 birds a day, 8 roosters and 4 hens. And I was corrected on that. Somebody told me that at one time you could shoot 16 birds a day, but I do not remember that. I do remember the 12 legal limit a day.
These pheasants?
And we lived on those pheasants. My dad illegally shot pheasants anytime we needed pheasants bad for the table. Because they was everywhere. They was in your way. Anything you plant, they'd dig it out. So to save what we did try to raise, we just shoot pheasants and scare them away. Well, we never wasted them. We always ate every bit of the pheasant, and the law didn't do anything about it. I suppose they knew we were illegally shooting them, but there was just so terrible many pheasants.
It's amazing that in a time of hunger and misery, that these pheasants could have come out like that.
Well, God provides, and just like he did for the Israelite people, he provided for them. And every day there was that dew on the grass, and that was manna from heaven, and this must have been manna from heaven that provided for us through that terribly hard time. And we just thank our Heavenly Father for what he did for us.
That is an incredible story, Roy. Wow, that in the midst of this drought and the misery and the people going hungry, there are those pheasants just coming out, yeah, multiplying so fast that you had something to eat. Wow.
But a lot of people didn't have the money to buy the shotgun shells, and sometimes they weren't available. During the war, shotgun shells was practically unavailable. But the peak of the pheasant population, I think, would probably peaked about 1944. Man, there was pheasants everywhere. You go through a 30-acre field, and probably 2,000 pheasants would fly out of that field. They're just going everywhere. I've seen hunters, some of them would ride with me out with the truck, because they didn't have gas to drive out. It was ration. So they'd ride with me. I had two guys from Rhinelander would ride out every year and hunt 2 or 3 days or a week, I guess, out here. And at that time, they could get 12 birds a day legally. And there were just pheasants everywhere because the war restricted the out-of-state hunters coming. And the only way they could come was with truckers, and they drove with me.
And fortunately, you were a trucker.
Well, I was I was about 28 years old when war broke out, but I had a wife and 2 kids, but I was hauling this grain to Wisconsin, and they needed that so bad to obtain the the grease and from the butterfat to make gunpowder during the war.
I was thinking when they were so hard up for money, they wouldn't even give you a car license until you had your taxes paid up. Did the county commissioners and all those guys draw a salary, or were they running out of money for a salary?
They were in the same boat. They'd get their warrant but couldn't cash it.
Oh, they had a check, but it wasn't any good?
While that mandate was on, that you had to have your taxes paid before you could cut. But like I say, they rescinded that after a few months. They see it was not working at all.
How about other people that are paid through the generosity and the contributions of the people, like the pastors? How did they make it?
They didn't. We had a Methodist minister here. He had one arm gone, and the kids named him Left Arm Johnson. But he was starving, being a Methodist minister. I can show you the house he lived in. He run for a legislative job, I think a representative. He got it. He went out to peer, and after he come back, they asked him what he thought of politics, and he thought a minute, and he said, "It's not for an honest man."
That's a fact.
At least he drew a little salary.
He had a little salary in the legislative session out at Pier, but he was starving being a minister, a Methodist minister.
And this went on for a decade, this type of...
About a decade, yeah, about 10 years, this monetary disaster, you might call it.
I'm looking around at the face of some younger people here, even younger than I, and there's looks of disbelief, there's looks of pity, there's looks of sorrow. These are sad stories, and yet...
They're real.
You people are so wonderful, possibly the character that you drew upon and grew with is what made you healthy and mentally alert of this day.
And very saving. We have a Scotch way of living. It just taught us to make the most of what few dollars we had and try to live on it.
I want to thank the people that helped me put the show together today, my production director. I want to thank so much Lucille Fitz for giving the ladies' viewpoint of those really, really rough years. And I want to thank Roy so much for inviting me into your home and letting me be part of your family and partaking of your coffee, which is some of the best coffee. Roy, you're a very lucky guy to have that good of coffee. Wow. Thanks for letting me roam around your farm. It's taken me back to the days in my childhood when I used to go out to my grandpa's farm. It's been quite a story. Thank you, sir.
And bete sein, and in German that means you're welcome.
Hey, have we got something in another language?
And I'll say mange tak, that means many thanks in Danish.
And many thanks to our listeners out there, wherever you're at. We hope that you've enjoyed the last 2 weeks that we've visited with Roy and Lucille Fitz. From a farm near D. Smith, South Dakota, this is Chuck Anderson saying, have a great week, everyone. Bye for now.